We want the result. We don't want the work.
I mean, you can't go somewhere and expect to be the star player. Like, you have to earn that every time.
Hello, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Jess Brown, one of your hosts. Today on the No Frids podcast, we're going to talk about what it means to put in the work to see results, not only in work, but your family and other endeavors that you might have. Really excited about this and had a lot of fun recording it. I hope you enjoy. Here's episode 3.
I'm waiting for the time, the week to go by where things aren't exponentially different than they were the week before. Mm-hmm. Like, it's this phrase of like, when's the bleeding going to stop? Kind of, I just want to stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
And then like healing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even know we haven't even been able to open up the wound to see what it is. Cause it's just like, we're in support mode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of coming from everywhere, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
I mean, even this podcast, like last week I kind of had a moment where I was like, I don't want to hear other people talk. I don't want to hear myself talk. I don't want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
What do I have to say? I'm just this silent observer in this weird moment in time.
Yep.
And who the hell am I to even have a point of view?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I don't know what I can contribute. You know, like, I do that daily kind of ask, like, this is weird, like, your company's called Aspiration, but I do these daily aspirations, you know, and they've changed.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last 3 weeks. Like, it used to be, you know, winning some kind of race, and they're not there anymore.
Yeah.
Because that's not important. Like, relativity has changed massively for me. Like, what is important, what's not.
What is important to you right now?
Getting through another week of work.
Mm-hmm.
putting another paycheck in the bank, making groceries last, keeping my fuel efficient. It's like based, and there's some peace in that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some peace that I have in doing that. Yeah, that's kind of where it is. Like, but lately, I think the things that I've been employing to stay sane is that I'm very goal, like micro, macro goal orientated. Like, I love lists. I love ticking off a list. It's satisfying to me. So I did a 10-mile paddle, five days ago. And I felt good. I felt tricked while I was out there. It felt like everything was a distant dream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you come back and it's there again. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this 10-mile paddle 40 days in a row. And so I kind of committed. I used Strava, and I posted my paddle on Strava and my split times, and I wrote 1 out of 40. Because like the social guilt, if I back out of it, I can't.
Yep.
I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially with the people that are, you know, kind of fall. I respect them a lot, and I don't want to be known as the guy that like sets goals and doesn't get to it.
Right.
So yesterday was day 5. Felt good. Day 4 felt like really gross. So
I would imagine that's mentally taxing too, because we've talked a little bit before about your routes. They're not super diverse. So
yeah, it's really repetitive. And normally I do it in the morning, and there's value in working out in the morning. You're clearer, your mental fatigue is low, your brain is recovered from a good night's sleep. But I've been trying to do it like at 5 o'clock, I pencils down and I drive to the bay to do it. And the mental fatigue that kicks in all the voices in your head that say like, yeah, you did four in a row. You're good. You don't do anymore. You know, they even show up in the form of like, this is selfish. You should go be with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in my community think paddling is selfish and they kind of aw shucks it. Like, oh, this is a selfish thing that we do. But in my opinion, it's a bit selfless. Like it's something that I have to do to take care of my mental health, you know? And there's balance in that. Like it has to be in windows and other areas have to be super strategic. But I definitely feel more whole afterwards. But normally I do it with people. Normally, you know, sometimes I'll have people in the water, but there's been no community at all.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Yeah. Like all the races that we do this year are all canceled. And that just kind of dawned on me yesterday and was like, dude, this is crazy. It's all gone. And so in the Catalina race, which, you know, all those races are technically qualifiers to get into, like, even though I've done it before, I don't have to re-qualify. But I'm wondering if they're going to cancel that race altogether. They canceled the Molokai race, which is the World Paddleboard Championships. And yeah, we're just entering into this very strange new normal. But I'm going to stop talking for a minute. I often ask people wherever I work, what would you do for a job? You have to work. Say you have to work. What would you do for a job if money was nothing to you? Like it didn't affect your day to day. Like you weren't worried about paying bills. You didn't have to hit a certain amount. And every team that I've ever been on, I have never heard anybody on any of my teams say that they would do exactly what they're doing at that moment. And I just ask, like, what would you do? And then you kind of hear this like really interesting variety of childhood dreams that crushed by reality or parental decisions or,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that come in. But here we are in this moment where it's like, what are, you know, you have to work, but like, what are you going to do with your spare time? Cause there's no social media really to brag on. Like,
yep.
not a lot of dialogue that normally happens is happening. Like no one's watching sports.
Mm-hmm.
Like I forgot about sports. Like what is sports? What's a sport? You know?
Yeah.
This would be a great time for China to introduce their sports networks. Like, you know, the Wuhan Table Tennis League would be like top notch here.
Wow, I know.
In the U.S., this is probably the only sport that's going. But like what? I'd paddle and surf. Mm-hmm. That's what I do, you know? So it's kind of a bit like comforting to know it's something that I love to do. I would do it even in the midst of like an apocalypse or whatever it is that we're in right now. Feels like yep. an apocalypse sometimes.
Yeah.
What about you?
Would you be
sitting in front of a computer 14 hours a day? I'm curious, Jess, yeah. What would you do?
So what I've been doing a lot lately has been
besides cat breeding.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole reason I got into design is because I loved drawing and photography. Like those were the two things that I loved. Still life, especially. So I've just been doing that. I've actually picked up some new. My daughter is quite talented when it comes to art. And for me growing up, I always did just graphite on paper stuff. I never did paints or pastels or any of that. So I'm starting to learn what it's like to work with color in a physical way. But as far as something that I would actually make money at, I don't, or not have to worry about money. I think what I love, even though it's exhausting, is community. So I've always joked if I retired, I'd go open a coffee shop just so I could be in the community, talk to people, maybe help them solve their own problem. I mean, I would still be a problem solver. Maybe it's just not with design. I mean, when I was growing up, I thought I was going to possibly be like a history teacher. Just because I love history and the lessons that are learned from it. But
that's interesting.
I outside of my own kids and a handful of my friends' kids, I cannot stand children. So I don't know that I would probably had to have been like a college professor or something like that to have actually made that
into
something.
They're pretty much children there too.
Yeah.
Trust me, I went back to college as a late. I was like, these are all kids.
Yeah, that my time in college, I did a lot of night school, so I was with a lot of the adults, so I actually enjoyed that way more than my peer classes. But that's
I think I hear that a lot in design. Like, I, you know, people were really into drawing or art, and that's usually the assumption, that like, oh, you must be really good at drawing, or you must be into drawing, or, and it's not the case for me. I think my draw into design was just the way that I structure my mind, and how structuring things has served me really well in this industry. I wouldn't say that I'm a very good designer, from, you know, like a purity sense, you know, like I'm not going to get featured anywhere anytime soon, you know, and that's fine. But I do know that I'm good at entering into ambiguity and bringing clarity. I'm good at entering into zones where there is no documentation and being able to formulate and build something. I mean, it's really why I've been able to add value in the organizations that I go to, is that something that normally takes a team of people 2 days to do, like I could get my team marching in a good direction in, like, you know, over a period of time.
Yeah. I have a friend named Shane that has talked about that. He calls it his tool belt, where you just take collections of projects you've done over the years and you just add to it over the years. And eventually you have everything that you need to be super efficient. The main goal, I think, with anybody's career is to learn from your mistakes, but also take the winning solutions and keep developing off of that. The whole concept of starting from scratch is not a smart thing to do. I mean, could you imagine starting a project with like a house?
No.
And brand new
no.
tools and all these other things every time you start a new project, instead of taking what you learned from building a foundation the first time. But I mean, maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Yeah. I remember the first time I interviewed at Google a long time ago, and they were like, well, what got you into UX design? Or like, why was it? And I gave a story of, when I was a Finnish carpenter, which the guy on the phone thought that I meant, oh, is that carpenters from Finland? So I knew I was dealing with a different cast character there. And I was like, no, like they're the carpenters that come in and do all the finishing touches and kind of hide the lines and put up crown molding and baseboard and, you know, built-ins and things like that. It's like, you know, it's cleaner carpentry. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of joy and efficiencies of that work. Like I knew that the velocity, like your velocity depended on like where you set your tools up, how you placed your material. And it was a package that you learned over a period of time. Like if you have a 18-foot run of baseboard and it's facing a certain way, that you have to literally pick it up and helicopter it around to get it onto your saw into the right position to make a cut, you're wasting so much time in knocking stuff over. So the goal is to set it up in a place where you can efficiently put it up, make a cut, not look like you're fatigued and work. Mm-hmm. And he just, it just, the analogy like flew right over his head. But for me, it totally makes sense. Like, how are you setting up your files? Like when I get into a project and it's still unclear, I'm instantly isolating 7 things that I can start doing before the brief is given or before the requirements are distributed, you know, like files can get, like, filing conventions can get set up, you know, presentation modules can get set up. There's so many things that you can do. And I think people wait for the baton to be officially passed before they start doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, myself and a couple people on my team have really mastered the art of that. And like the feedback we get all the time is like, how did you guys get this done so fast? And for us, it wasn't so fast. It was just that we'd started it before everybody thought that we'd started
it.
Because we had known certain things to be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know your own set of requirements. It's not your first time doing it. So, yeah, I mean, we're coming out of 3 weeks of that right now at work. And it's like, it's, yeah, if we waited till everything was handed off, we would not have hit any of the deadlines, like, at all. And what was crazy for me is, like, how much of what we did to nobody's fault, just still didn't get completely executed. Like they're in change orders right now, getting ready to go live and all that stuff. But like, it is pretty amazing that you can completely deliver as if you work that way on time and ahead of time. I think there's more value in that for a company than just the pixels at the end of the day. I mean,
yeah. Especially, no, and that's, I had that feedback from somebody who just joined our company, and this person was like, you do a lot more than just design. I was like, yeah. And I think when I'm like, say I'm interviewed for like a true kind of pristine ivory tower design position, I think oftentimes people mistake that for, what's the word I'm looking for? Like they mistake it for lack of experience.
Mm-hmm.
When they ask like, how do you do this? Or like, what's your process? And oftentimes because of the arenas that I've been in, I haven't had a lot of the tools that like more mature software organizations have. And so every question comes with like a clarifying question of like, well, what's the environment? Do I have an amazing development partner? Do I have product managers that are like contributors and helpers?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I alone as a designer that's being asked to like service the world? Because I approach problems differently from all those things. It depends. It's always, it depends. Like, it's like my life is a game of Zelda where it's like, what am I being faced with?
Yep.
You know, it's not always the same. And I kind of envy at times the design squad that can live in that very, you know, clean process. Cause I don't, it's never been that way. It's always been, striving and driving, mm-hmm. very entrepreneurial in my thought. And I think people that kind of get into a, you know, a rhythm, I think are a bit crutched.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, I don't have my thing.
Right. Yeah. I've never seen or found the company that runs that way. And I've never worked for is like 200 people. So like it, I guess that's probably part of it, but.
Well, I will say like at MGM, we hired we did an interview loop with, there's an agency that we work with and their designers sit pretty close to us. And so they usually put me on the interview loop to make sure that they're solid. And this designer had been at Google and Apple and had been at some, you know, very mature established design organizations. And the questions that she were asking were like really good. Like, hey, where's the PRDs? You know, and I had to be like, hey, what does that mean? What does PRD mean? You know, she's like product requirement documentation. And I was like, oh, those don't really exist. And so all these questions led me to believe that at some point would be frustrated with the lack of things that she was used to having. And I gave that feedback to the hiring manager. I was like, I don't know if she's going to, maybe, you know, I don't know if she's got the ability to kind of handle the ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be some future frustration. And she started and she literally lasts like 2 days. She was done. She's like, nope,
yep.
this isn't going to happen. So, I think it is out there and it's cool. But you know, I don't think it's out there in like the startup world. So I think everybody's like, you know, you want me to write requirements? I'll write requirements.
Mm-hmm.
we'll do it.
Well, let me ask you this. So, like, from your experience right now with MGM and maybe even Starbucks as well, it seems like people are gravitating to wanting to bring people on that come from the startup side and bring that more agile and lean mentality back to these bigger corporations. So do you find that to be true, or is it just due to the fact that people don't want to be organized? So that's just kind of part of it. They just want results with necessarily not being.
Say that again. Sorry.
Yeah.
People at Starbucks want to bring in this kind of startup disruptor mentality.
Right.
This Fortune 500 startup mentality. Yeah. I think that's the case. They do.
Do they want that because they want to avoid all the rules and the process and just feel like they're always moving and shipping, or is it, or have they truly realize that there's too much bloat?
I think they, you know, what Silicon Valley has done is that they have been able to stand viable businesses up in garages and on couches and, scale things to an economic prowess that these Fortune 500 companies, you know, are realizing like, man, if we don't adopt this, we're going to get left in the dust. And consumer expectations and habits are not being driven by us anymore. They're being driven by this new pillar that's showing up. And so we better get involved. I believe that that's true. I have a career based around it.
Mm-hmm.
But like the hangups come when, okay, you get sold, like, come be a disruptor, come do these things, but hey, you can't use Dropbox and you can't use Zoom. And so you have like, and it's like, it seems really small and petty, but like there's a series of questions that I think everybody, when they're getting into that area, they need to ask ahead of time, you know, because there are tools, like if I can't use Dropbox to share my files and have a place, like I have to use like Microsoft SharePoint, you know, I guess you could do it. I mean, it's fine. But I don't know. I think some people want it, but then they don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know,
yeah.
It's like, I want this. We want the result, but we don't want the work.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to talk too much. I'm sorry. But here's like an analogy. And I think we've talked about this before. So you and I are both dads of large families.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time you probably hear the same thing that I do, where it's like, oh my gosh, you're so busy. Or, oh, your wife must like be a saint. You know, it's like, it's always this, it's never met with like, oh, totally normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if we lived in like Amish country.
I live pretty close to Amish country, and yeah, it's not normal. Yeah.
Okay. But I've never really heard anybody say like, you know, get a sense that they felt it was normal. But oftentimes with me, I don't know about you, but I've been around your kids, and I would say that this is true for you too, that our kids are contributors.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're held to a high standard. They provide to the well-being of the family. They have chores, they do dishes, they do laundry. I haven't done dishes and laundry in almost 2 years now. Which is like, everybody assumes you have five kids that are all 2 years old at the same time.
Right.
But like, no, I have a 14-year-old that is like 2 years from driving, and like my wife and I can leave and we have a babysitter in the house all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not, you know, there's a lot of work involved. But so here's my point, is that say you paradigm shift with people because they assume like large families, chaos, crappy, but then you see us and it's like whole, happy, laughing, fun. And people tend to go, I want a part of that. And I get asked all the time, like, what's your secret? You know? And the secret isn't an easy answer. The secret is like, we've invested a lot of hard work and we've sacrificed a lot. And my wife and I have set ourselves aside, and we have like literally carved out portions of our body,
mm-hmm,
to give to our kids. I mean, not really, but like, that's what it feels like sometimes, you know, or it's like, this isn't necessarily fun in the moment, but it has like this end result that's grandiose. Mm-hmm. You know, it's bigger. And so like we know that and we try to explain it to people. But then it's like somebody wants that result and they come in and they just assess my house, for instance, and they say, well, Willie has these lights and he has these candles and he has this couch. So I'm going to buy those things so that I can have a house that looks like him, and then it'll just automatically happen. But people don't really know like what they're signing up for with these big transformations. Mm-hmm. Like it is really difficult.
Yeah.
You know, psychologically it's difficult for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
People feel threatened. So you're going to enter into an environment where everybody feels threatened by you because you're the new guy from this successful company. You think it would be the opposite, that you would have influence, but it's not. They don't want you. Every idea that you say is always, I kid you not, is always meant, yeah, we tried that, it didn't work, you know? And you have to learn how to like navigate that, have empathy for it.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting too, because I mean, I'm on the other side of that. I am a founding member of the company I'm at. So we have new people coming in all the time suggesting ideas that we've tried before. And I have to be really careful not to say that. It's like,
yeah,
we've tried that before. But what I keep telling people too is like, maybe we have tried it before, but it was a different time. So that's totally fine that it didn't work then. Like we were ahead of our time, or our customers weren't ready for that type of thing. Let's give it a shot again, you know? Tell them what the stories were to why you think it won't work so that they can maybe hopefully navigate it better than you did. But I love it when new people come in and are saying the same things that we were saying 6 years ago. It's like, okay, yeah, you're helping reaffirm what we believed, and you've got a whole new set of passion behind that. And maybe it will actually work this time. You've got more energy to see if this will fail or not. Like I've got 20 other things I need to worry about. Good luck.
Yeah.
Let me know how I can help. But yeah, shutting people down is just
you do get a bit salty. And so like if I've learned anything, it's not to dismiss the salty guy in those companies, because they have a lot of, it's actually the sooner you can employ the salty guy to be your homie, I think the better.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes like coming into that situation, salty guy feels threatened that, okay, so what if this person tries this new thing and then does it and then takes all the credit? Like that's a real thing that you feel. Like, and whether you want to say like, oh no, I'm above that, I have humility. That's hard. And especially in the world that we live in, it's like, oh, you were ineffective, so this person is effective. And that's not always the case. Like we as parents understand this in a different realm, because you could have taught your daughters or your son how to do a certain thing, or why to look a certain way, or to read a certain book, or to spend more time contemplating something and the value of it. And they just dismiss it for years and years and years. And then finally, some other adult figure comes into their life, or like some Jonas brother says it, and they're like, that's a great idea. And you're there going like, I've been saying this for 14 years. And it's annoying, but it's also, yes, you were saying it, and that's part of the process.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I wish more people recognize that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's also being willing to hear it. I think that's the big switch. Like for me, at least growing up, my parents said the same thing. And a lot, some of it doesn't even make sense to me to this day. But like every so often, I'm like, oh, they actually try to warn me about this. Or, you know, I've gone through difficult times in my relationship with my wife and my family. And, you know, you talk to people that have been around and done it before. And they're like, yeah, I've been through that. And you're in that moment, you're ready to hear it. But if they had just come to you one day and said, hey, you're going to hit hardships sometime in your future, and this is what you need to do, we're like, oh,
yeah,
you're crazy, dude. Everything's fine. You know, we're on cloud nine. That's not going to happen to me. So yeah, I, all that to say, I definitely agree with you. Like, aligning with the salty person is probably the best because they have the most amount of wisdom to share mm-hmm. with you as well.
And it's funny too, because like you take the salty person and you think they've always been salty, you know, and I think that happens everywhere. It's like context and spectrum and knowing like, well, what happened? Mm-hmm. Why are you this way? Like what, you know, and maybe they don't have never felt the permission to transform and change. And you could be that conduit of saying like, let's do this together. And as a new person coming in, elevating that person to have the win mm-hmm. is probably one of the best things that you can do. When I think fundamentally your belief is that you have to come in and elevate yourself. I get it. I totally understand. You're in a new job, new organization, new team. And you're like, I got to put points on the board. I got to be valuable. And I think it's much different than that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think immature leader would miss it, you know? But I think one of the best things you can do is elevate those around you first. Yeah. Cause then you get buy-in from them.
Yep. Well, I think about
they're
it too.
They're no longer
around. Well, yeah. And I was going to say like, if they've been around that long and they haven't left, I would say that those people probably fundamentally believe in what they're doing the most out of any of the other people. They are, like you said, they're stuck in a way that they haven't felt like they've been able to do like their final contribution.
Yeah,
they're not sick enough of it that they leave and go somewhere else. So I think a lot of people see them as like the complacent person. They're just always going to be here. They're always going to be the naysayer. But yeah. I think the reality is deep down in them, they believe in it the most. And they're just trying to be the voice of reason, you know, during that time. And it's not saying that, no, we can't do it. It's we can do it, but we need to do it maybe slightly differently or a little bit better or. I don't know. I always appreciate working with those people a lot. It's not easy though. Yeah. I think a lot of people give up on it because you have to work a lot harder to get into that.
I think being able to avoid broad critical statements early on in people, like I've had people say that to me now, people that are new at MGM, like, man, you're really burnt out. It's like, no, I'm not burnt out. I'm just trying to tell you, like, pie in the sky thinking is really awesome. Mm-hmm. I believe in it. And I have 60 timestamp presentations showing at a high fidelity, beautiful, award-winning level what could be for our digital ecosystem. I've done that. And that's awesome. I've been spending the last 2 years kind of doing that. But I think what we need to recognize, what I've learned, is where we are at. And be free and honest with where we are at as a technology organization. And everyone wants to talk about AI and third horizon innovation, but no one wants to talk about clearing tech debt, mm-hmm. pausing for stabilization, creating psychological safety for the people that are working, uprooting reactive, defensive, top-down nomenclature. That's not board member sexy,
right?
You know, like no one's going to go into a shareholder meeting and be like, well, I'm working on culture, you know, but it's really, really important.
Yeah.
You know? And so those people that come across as burnt out, which I'm not burnt out, but I'm not going to spin up another, what could be pie in the sky realm until, you know, some other things happen in other areas mm-hmm. that I know that it could get throughput,
yep.
you know, cause it's very isolating. It feels really lonely. And then you have somebody new starting that isn't a maker or a throughputter, but a thinker or an idea person. And it's hard not to be a bit salty about it. We're like, ugh, I don't need another guy in a meeting talking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Well, and I think that's the difference between somebody that's wanting to produce something with results versus just talk up what could be. I mean, you can play that game until your dying breath, but like coming in, showing up, making something actually happen that is putting you towards that step. I mean, back to what we were talking about at the beginning, like you're out there doing a 10-mile paddle. You don't have to be doing that at this point yet. Like you could be doing smaller things and you don't have to do 40 of them, but you know what the output will be for you on the long run, like mentally where mm-hmm. it's getting you to a place where that actual race will be less taxing mentally on you because you're going to do something way worse up front. And I think that ties right into the design mentality of that too. Like, you have to do the shitty work day in and day out so that you can make room for the really beautiful things and the things that actually make really big impact.
Yeah. And it's a tour of duty that knows it when it sees it. Like, so like what I mean by that, like if you've done a tour of duty in design and help move the needle at a place like Starbucks or like MGM or Albertsons, I don't know, some place that is not known for, you know, software, you know, really fast, like who kind of has that mindset and who's gone through it. Mm-hmm. And their expectations are different. Their approach is different. They have the battle wounds and scars to kind of, you know, realize that they had to jujitsu and rethink and rework and approach conflict differently and, you know, spell things out in a different way that almost seems like humiliating, mm-hmm. you know? But it's all a means to get to that end goal. And there are those that fold their arms and say, like, take my ball and going home. Like, this isn't what I signed up for. And there are those that said, hey, this is what I signed up for. And the achieving something here is far greater than going achieving it somewhere else. So yep. If I played in the NBA, I would play it on the 94 Seattle Supersonics. Sean Kemp.
Yep.
You know, Sam Perkins.
Peyton.
You know, Peyton, the glove. I wouldn't have played on the Bulls. I wouldn't have been like Kevin Durant, but just wants to like shop out championship teams and then collect rings. Mm-hmm. Because that would not have meant as much to me.
Yep.
You know, and if it wasn't for the damn Nuggets, the Sonics would have had a championship that one year that Michael Jordan was gone playing freaking baseball. but yeah, that would have been, you know, me and Detlef Schrempf, we would have been shooting hoops together. And I would have rather had that underdog, you know, go do it there. That's impressive.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. My team was the Spurs for that. Like, that was one of those teams. Like, they had Avery Johnson, Robinson, Kerr. Yeah. Like, it's all this, you know, that in unbelievable dedication and talent. And I don't know. There's some, I enjoyed watching Michael Jordan for sure, but it was one person and then a bunch of people to assist him, honestly, is how I've always seen him versus these other teams that literally are an entire team unit that are going to get there and make it happen together. Like the Raptors in this past year, like, they had Leonard, but that whole team was deep.
Yeah. That coach is solid. Yeah. The same thing with the Celtics, mm-hmm. you know, the Celtics were a great team. Then they added, I forget his name. He's playing for Brooklyn now.
Oh, but they like Irving.
Yeah, but they sucked when he was there because he was a superstar. Now they're, not now, but they were. Because the coach is solid. The coach is a good team. He's a good caster. He's a good leader, you know. And the focus isn't on the individual superstar. The focus is on the coach and the system and falling in line. I think both can work. You know, it's like if you look at LeBron James, he's the same way. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't stand watching him play because he's the epicenter. The coach is arbitrary, you know, and then it's like about adding pieces around him that make him better. Mm-hmm. And to me, I will root against that. I don't care. Like, you know, who's your favorite team? Whatever team's playing the Lakers.
Yeah.
That's my favorite team.
Yeah.
So I can't stand that, you know?
Well, and I think about that too, even back to something you were talking about earlier. So one of my favorite coaches was Phil Jackson, and it wasn't because of him with Jordan. It was his philosophy, the grounding mechanisms that he would teach his team. Like, the first time I ever even heard about meditation practices was watching a behind the scenes of the Bulls. And he's like, got everybody there, you know, centering themselves and whatever. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting is, like, he holds the record for the most amount of championship wins, both with like him as a player and then him as a coach. But his career was way better as a coach. Like, he knew the fundamentals of how to be a good player, but he could teach it way better than just
totally
doing that. Like, he didn't retire and just go do something else. Like, and what's great too is, like, there's something I looked up recently about him. Like, I think he owned about one of the teams or something, and he failed at that. And so,
yeah,
like,
in the mix, whatever he's doing.
So, you know, that was pretty awesome for me to see too. Is like,
he became a GM. He was a GM, and he was a terrible GM.
So, you know,
it's like good basketball players aren't always good coaches.
Right.
You know, and
good coaches aren't always good GMs. Like, I think that there's something kind of cool in there of like,
I love that. I love the coach that isn't an awesome coach, but never played basketball. I think that's like a great story because it just shows, it doesn't mean that I don't know. You see that a lot in design too. Mm-hmm. Like a good design leader doesn't have to be the guy that won all the design trophies.
Yep.
You know, and I think I was just talking about this with somebody else the other day. There's this tension, right? Between like the guy that's really good at making like high craft illustrations and he's just like focused and you know, got his Wacom tablet and like he's got like an air of pride to him, would look at somebody like me and say like, dude, you're not a very good designer. Like, don't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. Don't be my leader. But my request is like, number one for me is like, I should go in and try to do illustrations myself and understand like how hard that is. On the flip side, that person should do a stint trying to lead people and optimize that process. Because I think when they do, they go, okay, that's a lot harder than I thought it was. Because most of the time, those IC like heavy focused illustrators, they don't want to manage people. They don't want to ask people, how are you doing today on a scale of 1 to 10 during this coronavirus? Like, how can I help you? Like, don't worry about your baby screaming in the background. We're fine with that. I love it. Like, that's not their strong suit. Mm-hmm. They need to be cast in the right place. But I think inside and knowing, even from a basketball lens, like you can have empathy for a coach. And even if you don't agree with the coach, like you still need to like, I need to follow a coach.
Yep.
You know, and the players that succeed are the ones that I think get that.
Yep.
You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't go somewhere and expect to be the star player. Like you have to earn that slot every time. Like, I mean, I think that's where like team captain should be voted upon by the actual team. Like, I mean, like more like how it is in junior high and high school. Like my dad was team captain of his junior high team, but that was a peer voted thing. Like the coach is not awarding that. And I think that meant more to him than just that means one more person. To me. Right.
My team's sentiment towards me is the most important thing to me over like any leader. I honestly, feedback from my leadership, I have not met really the leader that I'm adopting. I haven't met the leader that I'm like, well, I really care what you have to say. Mm-hmm. But my team's feedback is super important to me.
Yep. I feel the same way about being a dad. Like if my kids are in love with who I am and they love being around me and all that means way more than to me than just the title of like, help bring you into this world and I take care of you. Like,
my job is to see you get to 18. I'm done. That's what I grew up hearing. My stepdad said that to me like every day. Once you turn 18, I could give a shit.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. Noted. As was yesterday, did I note that? You know, I think it's like when they turn 18, it gets real. That's when it gets real.
Yep.
You know, that's when they need you the most.
Hey, thanks for listening to the episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Really excited to share the next episode with you. Until then, enjoy your week, and we'll see you soon.